The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. Welcome again to The Urologist Speaks. This is Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, and I'm joined, as always, with my co-host, general surgeon and Bahamian surgical oncologist, Dr. Wesley Francis. Good evening, and thanks for being here again, Dr. Wesley Francis.
Good evening, Greg, and good evening, Bahamas. Always a pleasure to be here and to have these conversations as it relates to you and your health.
So, as always, we're trying to promote a healthier you. We want to promote longevity. We want to have as many years on this earth and as many good quality years on this earth for Bahamians and Bahamian residents. So, knowledge is key in terms of our nation. The health of a nation is the wealth of the nation. But information is imperative. So, we need to cut through a lot of misinformation, misconceptions, and we're going to talk hopefully every week about very important topics that are going to touch many of you and try to put you on the road to a healthier you and a healthier life. So we're going to talk about something very interesting today, and we're going to talk about dairy milk. The controversy regarding dairy milk. Is it really life's healthy elixir? Or is it really, as a lot of evidence in the last couple of decades has shown, is it really, quote-unquote, the white poison? What are the true facts regarding dairy milk and your health, and what are the potential negative health impacts of consuming dairy milk? So this is primarily going to be our discussion today, and there's a lot of ways of looking at it. We also have to look at the fact that a lot of information put out there, just like there's Big Pharma in North America, there's also big industry in terms of the dairy industry, in terms of the cheese industry. Dairy is a billion-dollar business. And a lot of marketing in the hundreds of millions of dollars is put into trying to make us feel good about drinking milk and the essential necessity in our daily life of drinking not only dairy milk, but dairy milk products. Cheese industry is also a billion-dollar business. So we need to cut through all of that and look at really, and we talk about in science and medicine, we talk about well-respected, long-term, randomized control studies, double-blinded studies that are not influenced, where there are no conflicts of interest, where nobody is being paid off, and there's no industry that wants to create a study to basically promote their product. What are your thoughts in regards to dairy milk, Dr. Francis? We'll talk about it just from your standpoint as a well-known surgical oncologist and expert in cancer health. What is the impact that you understand it in terms of cancer and dairy milk?
So I always start these conversations by first stating that a lot of studies out there talk about correlation rather than causation, right? And so, I mean, it's very important to define that. And whenever you're reading any piece of material, understand this is correlating, and sometimes that there can be positive correlations, negative correlations, and then there can be spurious correlations, right? A good example is if you wear a blue shirt, it rains every day, right? Not likely. It means just that it's so hot, but it's probability-wise, it does that. So,
or you can even look at it this way. For example, if you look at what is the risk of drowning, is there association between eating ice cream and drowning? So a lot of persons who hang out in the sun, in the pools, right, on the beach, yeah, they're going to consume more ice cream because
on that day.
And it's not causation,
not cause, right?
But there is some loose correlation regarding to saying the numbers will say, all right, those who consume more ice cream are likely to more likely to drink.
Right, which right. Is, so from a scientific perspective, I mean, if something is causative, then you know it's directly causes this. And I think we try to do that, look at those things in research. Now, as far as my reading from a cancer perspective, yeah, I know for prostate cancer, and certainly this is more your area than mine, there's insulin growth factor 1, which there has been shown correlations that it increases your risk of promotes prostate cancer growth. but there's some other studies out there that are in favor of dairy products or milk, and that is, and it may be preventive, for example, with breast cancer and colon cancer, from the perspective of it increases your amount of vitamin D and calcium in the body. And so vitamin D has its own preventive effect on breast cancer and colon cancer and other cancers too. So in
we also have to say that is correct, obviously, but right. There are other sources of vitamin D. You don't have to get it from dairy milk.
No, you don't.
And
you
other health effects of consuming dairy milk, you can still get vitamin D from numerous other sources.
But I think most people, and again, I think we mentioned this even last night, right? Because vitamin D you can get from going out in the sun. But most of us, especially those with more pigment, are vitamin D deficient. So you have to get an exogenous source, right? And usually dietary related rather than, you know, because most of us, we walk around, you need to expose a lot more part of your body to get enough vitamin D from sunlight, right? So there's a balance. And I think my view on it is that you have to review the literature out there with some kind of jaundiced eyes. It depends on who's writing it.
and as you say, always look for conflicts of
interest. Right, conflicts of interest.
Who actually engineered the study.
Right, who's paying for it,
essentially. Yes.
So obviously the dairy industry is paying for a certain study. You have to look at that with some suspect. But there are benefits and there are risks associated with it. If you are lactose intolerant, then you can't really absorb or derive the benefits, the dietary benefits from milk, because you can't absorb it, right? And then it then leads to a lot of GI upset, and it creates this inflammatory environment. That is not good. Whenever it is that you have a pro-inflammatory environment, that then leads to, again, an environment that's more prone for carcinogenesis or developing cancers. So I don't know that the jury is out yet. And you have to, again, weigh the literature and look at it. There are the pro-inflammatory risk associated with it, but then there are also the preventive benefits as it's associated and related to vitamin D, calcium, and that effect, that whole hormonal environment that creates. So that's my view on that.
Well, for prostate cancer, as you mentioned, it's more conclusive. In fact, the EAU, European Association of Urology, actually will, in its guidelines, mention that higher levels of dairy milk intake can, in fact, influence and increase your risk of prostate cancer by as much as 30%, particularly for black men, which, as a black nation, we primarily are. It's the way that black men actually will digest, and the metabolism of calcium is different for black men versus our other racial counterparts. And that's a lot of physiology and pathophysiology that I won't get into.
But I recently was having a conversation with a geneticist out of Bermuda. And, you know, they're doing multi-genetic panels on prostate cancer, right? And what they're finding, for example, with breast cancer, obviously, if you're a BRCA gene family, you almost lead directly, increases your risk of breast cancer almost up 75-80%. But they're not finding that with prostate, right? It's like a polygenetic, multiple genes coming together to actually lead to increase people's risk. And then when you combine that with all of these environmental factors, like, for example, dairy milk, as you say, IGF-1, increases as a result of dairy milk, then you see how you can create this environment, especially in black people.
Yes, right? So for prostate cancer, the number one risk factor for prostate cancer is advancing age. It's a disease of advancing age. The second highest risk factor for prostate cancer, unfortunately, for our nation and for many Caribbean and African nations, is that we have a higher risk of getting prostate cancer at an earlier age and a more aggressive form of the disease if you're of African or black ancestry. It's almost a different entity. It's almost, we can always describe it as being a very prejudiced and racially biased disease. So that's why we always have to be very diligent and proactive in picking up
prostate cancer early. That must relate to our genetics.
It relates to our genetics in some regards. Right. A lot of it is related to how we metabolize calcium, but in terms of familial, there is some increase. Let's say you have two first-degree relatives. That might increase your risk of getting prostate cancer by 15%. It's not exponential. The environmental factors, such as your diet, play more of a role in terms of your body habitus, being obese or not. So the Western diet is going to promote you getting prostate cancer versus, for example, the Asian diet, where the levels of prostate cancer are the lowest in the world.
So especially on the background of that increase from a genetic perspective, right? So we talk about nature versus nature. Nurture versus nurture.
Yes.
And nurture would speak to the environmental effect, the dietary habits and all of that. So if you're at an already increased risk because of your genetics, then when you have these behavioral or what we always talk about, modifiable factors, then you can see how that further increases your risk overall.
Well, there are two interesting studies. One looked at black persons who had migrated to Asia, where their diet was completely different, where they basically immersed themselves in the culture and they were eating the Asian diet. And they looked at the next generation of persons of African ancestry. Many of them had come actually from Africa or even United States. And the next generation, and they looked at the risk of prostate cancer versus where they originated from. And they found that within one generation, the risk of prostate cancer was on par with their Asian counterparts because of the diet alone. Another study looked at persons from Japan, where it's one of the lowest rates of prostate cancer in the world, and then they migrated to California in the United States, and then they took on that Western diet. Within one generation, the risk of prostate cancer was on the level of Americans versus their family that were back in Japan. So diet is all important.
So I those researchers probably got the took the idea from the colon cancer researchers, right? Because we always talk about a Western diet as it relates to colon cancer. If you take someone from Africa and you look at their generation and what their nutrition, their culture, and what they eat, and compare it to the same black person, you transplant them into the West, they have a several multifold, almost 20-fold increase in cancer as it relates because of that same Western diet alone.
Yeah.
That high in saturated fat, low protein, low fiber, all of that. And so, again, that's why we're always here emphasizing how diet, and also exercise, of course, but diet and modifiable risk factors influence your outcome.
Another study, I think I've mentioned on the radio before, and it's very interesting. They looked at packs of wild dogs in Africa, and cancers, all cancers, in that subgroup of wild dogs in Africa, cancer was almost unheard of. And then you look at the cancer incidence and rate in domesticated animals, dogs in North America. It's very high. It's significantly high, and in many cases, for certain cancers, higher than even humans. And it's related to diet and diet alone. When we talk about, there's a lot of industry promoting milk does the body good. You always hear that slogan. Or we have these commercials where persons are with a milk white mustache and talking about how fundamental milk is for your bone density, for your bone health. And actually, I'm going to get into it. That's actually opposite of the truth. When we talk about the countries in the world that have the lowest calcium intake per person, per capita, Asia, rural Africa, they have the lowest rates of osteoporosis. They have the lowest rates of bone fractures as persons progress and become elderly, versus countries, Western countries, first world countries, developed countries that have the highest rates of calcium intake, highest rates of dairy milk intake, very horrible diet with high protein, very acidic diet.
But you know, and this is where multiple factors come into play. And statistically, we talk about, you know, multi-regression models, right? And you try to pick out the one thing that correlates more. So if you look in on the eastern side of the world, they tend to move more. And so there is an interplay between diet and there's an interplay between movement alone.
Oh, it's right? Definitely multifactorial.
So,
it's very multifactorial.
So it's totally, yes. So you have to strike a balance somewhere. I think if you standardize and you control for movement alone, right, and then you apply all these diet, you may see something different. But, you know, all of those are studies that you have to look at. And so this is why we can't look at one thing in isolation, because there's so much variables associated with it.
Well, we look at the most important thing, as I was just mentioning, milk does not reduce bone fractures in the face of popular belief. So when you have...
So movement probably
movement
does more.
And vitamin D
and
does
vitamin
more.
Vitamin D does more.
Exactly.
But it depends on how you get your vitamin D.
Correct.
Right? So
yes.
The dietary sources of vitamin D.
So I don't want to understate right. The importance of calcium. Calcium
Absolutely.
Is fundamentally important to almost every bodily system. And
yes, that's its benefit.
There's so many ways of getting calcium.
Absolutely.
You don't need to get it from dairy milk. That's
no,
the
you
most
don't.
That's the most important thing. So let's put it in perspective in terms of even when you talk about women or postmenopause or elderly men and women, we talk about calcium supplementation. And that's a topic for another day in itself. Most of these supplementations do very little in
Absolutely
terms of benefits.
Little. Right.
In fact, most of the calcium...
And we pay a lot of money for it.
Yeah, it's all marketing. It's a $1 billion business in
Huge.
Itself. You feel better about taking it. A lot of it, you do more harm than good. In fact, a lot of the calcium in terms of supplementation, it just runs right through you.
Runs right
it's
through.
Not even absorbed. So
right.
it does nothing to improve your bone health. It does nothing to stay off you having osteoporosis for postmenopausal men and for
So I always tell people
for
this, is that the body is a well-oiled machine, right? You can't over... You It's not going to take more than you actually give it, unless in fact you inject it or you put it directly into the bloodstream. But certainly through the GI tract, there's so much feedback mechanisms that prevents you from absorbing large amounts of these things, right?
Yeah, so when we look at calcium and we have to look at how do we absorb calcium, what the problem with milk is that it does have a high calcium intake, but it also has a high phosphorus volume to it as well. So when you get milk, you get calcium and you get phosphorus. And what happens is that the calcium will bind to the phosphate and it will form calcium phosphate or calcium diphosphate. And in that form, you cannot absorb the calcium. So the calcium phosphate, the calcium dysphosphate or biphosphate cannot be absorbed by the body. So when you look at the amount of phosphate in dairy milk, it basically prevents you from absorbing the calcium. So it's basically useless.
Well, you get some because the amount of calcium in dairy milk is so high that you do get some because it crosses
very little. And then we have to look at the hormonal ill effects of it. We talk about estrogens. We talk about IGF factor 1.
Right.
When you need to absorb calcium, when you're looking at calcium metabolism, for effective calcium metabolism, when you have phosphate present, you need to have a ratio of calcium to phosphate 4:1. So for every 4 calcium molecules, you need 1 phosphate to really have effective calcium absorption. For milk, it's actually the opposite. So you have 1 calcium for every 2 phosphate. And that's just going to be prohibit you from being able to absorb calcium at any effective level.
So one thing I would say, right, and we had an endocrine person, we had Dr. Curlin here last week, and, you know, calcium is very efficiently metabolized in the body. And you have calcium stores, which is the bone, and then you have ways of getting calcium through the diet. And there's a hormone called PTH that monitors this, right? And it's such a narrow range, and that's well monitored, and that's well maintained. So again, if you take a huge excess of it, the body won't absorb it, right? So the body really takes in what it needs.
Correct.
Especially when it's that whole hormonal environment is moderated, that's the term we'd use, by PTH and vitamin D. So it's an entire orchestra. So it's not as simple as that.
And the body's protected.
It's very efficient.
So if you overdo it with calcium, you're not going to die of calcium toxicity.
No, you won't.
You're not going to have deposits of calcium in your muscles and everything else because right. The body gets rid of it. It only absorbs what it needs. But it has to be in a form in which it can be absorbed. So take-home message is calcium isn't as bone-protective as widely thought. A lot of that is misinformation put out there by the billion-dollar dairy and cheese industry, primarily in North America, just as big pharma is all important and has influence in making contributions to Congress and the USDA and everything else. You always have to take things with a grain of salt.
But I'll also say that moderation is what's important in everything, right?
Correct.
Because the benefits of milk are seen with the amount of protein that you can get from milk, the calcium, as we've stated, vitamin B, right? And all the fat-soluble vitamins, that is vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin E, vitamin K. So, again, I think the way we have to look at this is to not look at the extremes, but in moderation. You do need some of it. Now, you can switch from animal-based to plant-based, right? And, I mean, there's a whole plant-based push out there. But overall, it's the moderation in your intake associated with movement, exercise, that I think makes the best sauce, per se, to give you the best outcome.
I mean, you look at the healthiest people on earth, and most of them are in rural parts.
Yes.
And undeveloped parts, third world countries. We'll even look in rural family islands of the Bahamas.
The blue hole.
Yeah.
You know, those people, they are.
I mean, how many people in Rumkey and...
Some of my oldest patients are from the island.
Exactly. Are they on calcium and supplementation? No. But so, I mean, long-term...
And they get milk from other sources, exactly. Right?
Long-term, yeah. Plant-based.
Coconut milk.
Exactly.
Almond milk.
Almond milk is wonderful. I'm saying milk is essential, but not dairy milk. And we have to look at dairy milk products as well. So even long-term scientific studies have shown conclusively that calcium supplementation in itself has little or no benefit in reducing fracture risk. So vitamin D is, in fact, it is shown to be much more preventative in regards to bone fractures than calcium. So calcium, as I say, is fundamentally important. It's essential for multiple bodily functions. You need calcium for muscle function, for contraction, for relaxation. You need bone is its vital role in building and maintaining strong bones and teeth, obviously. It's important in facilitating nerve signal transmission. It's important in ensuring a proper blood clotting occurs within the body, normal blood clotting. But higher intakes of dairy milk, dairy products have shown to increase a man's risk, as I said, from a urologist standpoint, of prostate cancer by 25 to 30%. In fact, studies have shown that the threshold in terms of dairy milk intake for a man should not exceed 1 3/4 cups per day. And that's, you have to look at it cumulatively, not just in terms of straight dairy milk, but also looking at what you're getting from dairy milk products as well, and cheese is one of the more common ones.
I mean, I think in general, minimizing animal products, that's that's what recommendations are out there. And when you minimize animal products, you get the benefits in cancer prevention, as we'd mentioned. And also cardiovascular health. We can't forget cardiovascular health, right? Because that is important. I mean, animal products, saturated fat, and all of that increases your risk of cardiovascular.
Milk and cheese are very high in saturated fats. And coronary heart disease, is the number one killer in the world. And just in the Bahamas is no different. It's the number one killer in this country as well.
So I think we should probably, again, stress moderation, tilt the balance toward a plant-based diet, right? Where 2/3 should probably be vegetables, whole grain, beans, plant supplements. And then 1/3 lean protein, right? Lean protein that would include fish or chicken and minimize the significant amount of animal products. I think in general, if people would moderate their behaviors and activities and what they eat, I think that would be, you know, they would see a change in the way their bodies react to things and reduce their risk overall.
And we always stress the point that a lot of your future health, your present health, is in your own hands. We talk about environmental factors. We talk about modifiable risk factors. Yeah. We talk about avoiding obesity, limiting alcohol intake, certain foods, and we're including with that dairy milk. If we can do those things, we're going to live longer and we're going to live better.
Organic. Organic. We need to talk about that too.
Yeah, and then we just talk about cows in general. We talk about the antibiotics given to them. Right. We talk about the
pesticides
and the grain that they are given. So you have to look at what are we intaking as well. But we also want to stress that milk is fundamental in terms of breast milk. There is no healthier form of food for a human baby. So when we talk about breast milk, it's absolutely essential for human development, 100%. For nutrition, for new immune system development, for human babies. But when we talk about bottle feeding babies, formula is estimated it could lead to the demise of over 1 million children worldwide every single year, versus whether they were breastfed over formula fed. So that's essentially important when you talk about the incidence of.
I think one of these days we need to bring a pediatrician in here
to talk about the same
breastfed versus bottle fed. And how you introduce these things to
and avoiding giving children antibiotics as well.
Right.
Yes. Well, I know a wonderful, kind, very experienced veteran pediatrician in the form of Maria Francis, your wife. So please, let's bring her on. I know she's here listening to you and supporting us.
I won't be here that day, right?
Oh, okay. All right. So when we talk about even crib death, you can have 2 to 4 times greater risk of crib death if you're formula fed versus breastfed. When you talk about estimation, the greater risk of a baby developing pneumonia within the first 3 months of life, that is exponentially higher. As some studies will say, 60 times greater for formula fed versus breastfed babies. And that's astonishing. If you're breastfed, even as an older child, as a teenager, as a young adult, older adult, you have a greater risk of asthma, eczema, type 1 and diabetes, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, if you are formula fed versus breastfed. So please, women, families, please breastfeed your baby. Even if it means actually using a bottle, but providing the breast milk within the bottle itself. It'll be fundamentally important for the health of your child, the future health of your child, the present health of your child, the health of your family, and ultimately the health of our nation. So we can't stress that even more than we are saying now. Breast milk is fundamental. But when you look at the negative impacts of milk, we're talking about dairy milk, we have to look at dairy milk is an ideal food for baby cows, for calves, not for us as human beings. We look at, basically through evolution, God has made it as the most important food that he's going to provide us is going to be breast milk for that species. That's going to be fundamentally, and that's going to be formulated essentially for that species.
And to unlock the nutrients associated with milk, you have to have lactose, right?
Correct.
And as we get older, we tend to be lactose intolerant.
Yes.
And hence, you tend to see the ill effects of dairy milk when it is that you see people who are lactose intolerant.
Yes. So after the age of breastfeeding, there's a high percentage of persons worldwide who become lactose intolerant. Yeah. And they don't know why. So they just go through life with GI symptoms or eczema or worsening asthma. And you can actually take, and it's because of the lack of the enzyme lactase. Right. You could actually supplement and take lactase and be able to enjoy milk products.
Right.
A lot of persons don't know that. And black persons of black ancestry have higher risks of being lactose intolerant. Persons of Jewish heritage also have higher risk of developing lactose intolerance. Another thing we look at, we look at one of the qualities of an animal species, the milk that it provides. It's the need to be related to the specific species growth. So when we're looking at some of the figures concerning growth of an animal species, you look at the comparison to the protein intake. So for human breast milk, it has 1.2 grams of protein for every 100 milliliters of human breast milk. And the human growth development doubling rate for a baby is approximately 6 months. When we look at a cow in dairy milk, the cow's dairy milk has 3.3 grams of protein for every 100 milliliters of dairy milk. So 1.2 grams for breast milk, 3.3 grams of protein for dairy cow milk. And cows have a growth doubling time of 47 days. 47 days versus 6 months. So God has engineered dairy milk for calves and has engineered breast milk for humans. Let's not mix that up.
So basically, if you do the math, you're basically overfeeding your child.
Exactly that. Right. Exactly that.
Right. You're giving more protein than they actually need.
Very much so. So when we look at some of the most addictive foods out there in terms of negative foods,
sugar. Yeah.
A lot of that is related to dairy milk. And we talk about things that are contained in the products such as cookies. We look at pizza, for example. Pizza is one of the most addictive foods out there. And a lot of it is related to cheese. When we look at the poor Western diet, the unhealthy diet, the high protein intake, the high processed food intake, we look at the acidity of foods and the negative impact even on bone health. We also looked at one of the most acidic foods out there. It's mozzarella cheese. Mozzarella cheese that's contained in almost all pizzas is one of the most addictive foods as well, and it's consumed in North America and the Bahamas and throughout Western society in high volumes, extremely high volumes. So we have to look at our diet. If we can change our diet, if we can change our lifestyle, we can do away with the sedentary lifestyle, we're all going to live longer and we're going to live better, and even our last decade on this earth is going to be a lot better than if we continue to live and eat and behave badly.
So on the next end of the break, we should perhaps hopefully get some calls in. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have some ideas and opinions on what we've discussed. So please call in.
We'll talk more on the other end of the break. This is Urologist Speaks.
Get ready to kick off the new school year with a bang. It's the Guardian Media Group and Rotary Club of South Ocean's Back to School Jamboree. Friday, August 29th in the parking lot of the Nassau Guardian in Oaksville, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Join us for a day of fun, games, and back to school excitement. We've got something for everyone, from bouncing castles and face painting to health screenings, hair grooming, and giveaways. Meet some of your favorite local businesses and get ready for the new school year with all the essentials. We'll have school supply vendors and local eateries with delicious treats. Don't miss out on the fun. The Guardian Media Group and Rotary Club of South Ocean's Back to School Jamboree. Friday, August 29th at the Nassau Guardians parking lot, 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's the perfect way to celebrate the end of summer and get excited for a great school year. See you here.
Brought to you by The Walking Clinic, Boss, Alive, FML, Asa H. Pritchard, Nassau Agencies, Original Parties, Caribbean Bottling Limited, Purity, Ari the Artist, Little Caesars, Marco's, Wendy's.
Beulah gal, can you believe this? We are now the patrol queens of the neighborhood.
We now large and in charge. So we need to check out what's going on in everybody's yard. What about that gun that we know that Junior and his homeboys just ran out? Can we report that too?
Of course we can.
But we could be in deep trouble if they find out.
We need to report what we see, Beulah. When you call Crime Stoppers, they just answer your call in Miami.
So then we can report everything? Guns, where they hiding the drugs, who shoot who part of which gang, or who disturbing the peace with the loud music and the motorcycles.
Then our neighborhood will be the best in the Bahamas, and everybody gonna want to come live here. And then our house price will go up, gal.
So what we waiting on? What's the number?
If you see something, say something. Let us all pitch in and stop the crime before it's your time. Call 328-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands, or text us through the Crack Crime Bahamas app. Stop the crime before it's your time.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Dr. Gregory Pinto, urologist and surgical oncologist, Bahamian, Dr. Wesley Francis. So we were talking at the other end of the break about the dangers of dairy milk, which many of our colleagues around the world will say it's the secret white poison. So we're looking at just summarizing some of the ways that dairy is ruining your health, and we're talking about not just dairy milk, but dairy milk products such as dairy milk derived cheese as well. You have to look at to maximize production of dairy milk. Essentially, the dairy industry attempts to make cows perpetually pregnant. And what is the effect of the hormones that we're receiving through dairy milk because of that? So this results in over 200 times the normal levels of female hormones in dairy milk. These hormones can be disastrous, from estrogens, as we mentioned previously, to insulin, growth factor 1, particularly in relation to prostate cancer, and increasing the risk of prostate cancer by as much as 25 to 30%. So we as a nation, I'll always hammer this home, we have all the risk factors for prostate cancer. Prostate cancer is one of the easiest cancers to pick up. If you can pick up prostate cancer when it's early, a low-volume disease, the chance of 10-year survival is nearly 98-99%. There are very few cancers that you can say that. So anyone who dies in our society from prostate cancer is an unnecessary death. And over 100 men in this country are dying needlessly, many of them in their prime, from prostate cancer. And it's not an easy death. It's not. It's an emotionally expensive death. It's a financially expensive death. The toll on the family. One day you're the breadwinner, next day you're a burden on your family, you're going to die a slow death, needing expensive medications, in and out of hospital, maybe 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, and your grandchildren are going to see that, your wife is going to see that, your nieces are going to see that, and you don't have to go through that when there's so many minimally invasive ways that we can treat prostate cancer.
So let's talk about that a little more, Greg, because you speak of statistics in terms of the deaths related to prostate cancer, and I've seen a lot of those patients, and the pain that they have at the end of life, and the burden that, you know, they leave on the family, and the disability, and again, for something that is totally preventable. So there's a huge gap there, right? I mean, it's a totally preventable disease from the perspective of or at least presenting at that late stage. And it's easily treatable, right?
As I've said before, right. We can pick up prostate cancer very early. Right. Where it's an incidental finding, low volume, low risk, where we can actively surveil persons for many years before we need to cure them.
So even if, right, you cannot prevent prostate cancer because, you know, you have a prostate, chances are with your genetics and all the other factors, you can't get it.
Right? Or just being a black man.
A black man.
Is 1 in 6.
You can get it.
In the United Kingdom, men of African and Caribbean ancestry, it's 1 in 4. So you can imagine those numbers. African Americans, it's 1 in 6.
Exactly, 1 in 6, right? And it's more than actually breast cancer, right? Because breast cancer is like 1 in 12.
Yes.
So think about this now. And if it's something that can be picked up very early.
And then even further, if you live to long enough,
everyone's going to get it, right?
God has made it so that everyone's going to get prostate cancer.
Everyone's getting it, right.
But the vast majority of men...
But it's an indolent cancer.
That's where you don't know what's indolent and what's not. Some are very aggressive. So the vast majority of older men, we don't even look for prostate cancer because the vast majority of them, maybe 96, 97% will die with it, not from it. They'll die from old age.
Exactly.
So when we look at, are we going to employ a curative treatment for prostate cancer, we looked, is someone likely to live 10 years? And
it's intense selection then.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. But now we even are further stratifying patients in terms of higher risk and those who are likely to have recurrence and those who need treatment right away. And that's where we have liquid biopsies. And that's where we have genetic testing on our prostate biopsy specimens so that we can stratify and say, all right, this person has a 2% chance of a recurrence of prostate cancer in the lifetime versus someone who might have a 35% chance.
So we do that in most cancers, right? You select the best out, right? And you put them in a low-risk category. They don't need the aggressive treatment, right? The cost of treating that person is not that significant. But then you have the more aggressive ones. And certainly being of African descent puts you in that category. So then the emphasis then should be on early detection, to detecting this very early, and then figuring out who are going to be the ones that will develop and become more aggressive, and versus the low risk ones, and treat those. That's essentially what we do for most cancers.
Exactly, but our mantra of our radio show is that we want to promote preventative medicine. We don't want just to be reactionary. So yes, it's wonderful to have the best drugs available, even through NHI, for metastatic prostate cancer to give somebody an extra 6 months. But
here's the interesting fact, right? We can't prevent breast cancer.
Yes. Well, you can. There are modifiable risk factors that can reduce your risk. Yes.
So our emphasis really is on early detection, right? Because if you detect people at an earlier stage, then you can better treat them and they have a better outcome, better survival. And same with prostate cancer. If you identify it early, stratify it into low risk, those people tend to do very well.
We can even take it further, looking at colon cancer, where a colonoscopy is both diagnostic and therapeutic and prevent you from... So no one should be dying of colon cancer except those very select few who are... Delta very poor deck because of genetics. They're going to have a very aggressive form of colon cancer, even at 28, at 32.
You more often than not, you cannot do much for those people in terms of early detecting or preventing, right? Unless it is that they know about their family. And the only way they can do that, I said this on a show the other day, is if they have a relationship with their doctor who will make them more aware of such things. Because that discussion comes up, right? Mm-hmm. And if you know that in your family history is such that you had multiple members in the family with colon cancer, with prostate cancer, then your screening now becomes individualized.
Correct.
I think that's what we try to emphasize sometimes. Yes, we have screening guidelines for population, but we also have screening guidelines for individuals. Because of your family risk. And this is why it's important to have a relationship with your primary provider.
But the problem with our society, and I'm sure you've seen it, and I see it, if not every day, every other day, is that when we talk about history and we ask, do you have any family history of prostate cancer or colon cancer, Unfortunately, yeah, because we have a matriarchal society, a lot of persons don't even know who their father is.
True.
Or they don't know anything about the health of their father paternal family.
I always look at the upside of things. You know 50% of it, right? I mean, 50% is a lot, but I like to think of glass half full rather than half empty. Yes. Even if you know 50% of your history, that's a lot. That's something that we can work with, right? We'd like the whole thing, right?
Correct.
And our culture is what our culture is. So we have to work with what we have.
Correct.
But the emphasis, I would say, is that if you have that relationship with your primary care physician and have these discussions, then you have now an individual screening rather than what we often talk about from a population screening perspective.
So I'll just talk about what you can do, because as a nation, almost every man in our nation has high risk for prostate cancer. There are modifiable risk factors. There are exposures that we can limit. We even talk about you getting a sexually transmitted disease at 18, at 20. That increases your risk of getting your prostate cancer at 70. So having HPV in your past, having syphilis in your past, having chlamydia, even if you treat it, can increase your risk of getting prostate cancer at a later date. So always wrap it up. Always practice safe sex for so many different reasons. HPV is also the most prevalent sexually transmitted disease. There's so many HPV-related cancers as well. We talk about cervical cancer.
We talk about
HPV. Again, let's hammer home getting the HPV vaccine.
Vaccine.
When young boys and girls.
And girls.
That's why it's important to bring on.
We should say girls and boys. Because everybody think, why do you have to give a boy an HPV vaccine?
Well, there are HPV-related cancers that they can...
They're the spreaders.
They can spread it.
They're the spreaders.
Exactly that.
People don't realize that. You're going to break this thing down. They are the spreaders.
And you can have an increased risk of penile cancer, which, Lord, you do not want to have.
Nobody wants that.
That's the worst of the worst.
But you were circumcised those prostates less, right?
HPV also increases your risk of getting penile cancer. Yeah. But you don't want to know that you see that you're the wife of your three children is dying of cervical cancer at the age of 30 because you were wayward and reckless in your teens and you gave her HPV and you never even knew that you had HPV.
No, you didn't know.
For most persons, HPV, it dissipates and you get rid of it on
its own. Absolutely.
But the more times that you are exposed to it, the greater risk that you can have. And then even talk about oral cancers. We're going to have ear, nose, and throat specialists on soon. But you don't want to get an HPV-related cancer.
HPV-related cancer in the oral cavity.
Correct.
And you know how you get that.
Yes. So you always want to be safe and being reckless. Far too many men and women at a young age, teenagers, young adults, they live like they're impervious to anything. They're invulnerable to anything. They're Teflon. Nothing can touch them.
Yeah, but you see, we have an opportunity to be responsible.
Yeah.
Right? And responsible in that we have access to HPV vaccines that can change a whole generation.
It can almost eventually eradicate cervical cancer in our nation in the next generation.
One vaccine.
In just one vaccine.
We just need to give it to the ladies and give it to the boys.
And it's free of cost and readily available. Yes.
Right at the clinic. Something, that's our primary prevention program that the government has put in place, Ministry of Health.
And you and I always see persons dying of cervical cancer. I've mentioned it before. We know the people in cervical cancer who have stage 3 and stage 4 just from the smell alone. It almost smells like rotting flesh. And you can smell it down the corridor. You go through the gynecology ward. You only have to go in. And the stench is horrible for every patient, for every person working there. And you can imagine the indignity of someone dying with that horrid smell.
And that's one. Anal cancer is something also that we don't talk about that much, right?
Well, that's under your purview.
And that's HPV-related also.
Yes. For men and women.
And women.
Correct.
And anal receptive intercourse.
Yes.
People do that, right?
Correct.
So,
and the vast majority of anal cancers present late.
Present late.
Yeah.
And they come with those large fungating masses coming out of their anal canal. And that's difficult to treat.
Yes.
Right? And again, how can you prevent that? HPV. You can minimize that. Well, besides the behavioral aspect of it.
And the vaccine.
The HPV. Yeah. Right?
And I mean, this vaccine is not, we're not lending ourselves for irresponsible behavior.
No.
It doesn't prevent you from getting HIV. It doesn't prevent you from getting syphilis. You still, if you get herpes, you keep it for life like luggage.
Right. Yes. you're not gonna get out of that.
And hepatitis, actually, certain forms of hepatitis are more deadly than HIV.
Yes.
Because you can have antiretrovirals and you can make your HIV basically undetectable, and it can be like a chronic illness.
It is a chronic illness now.
But hepatitis, when you get liver cancer, that's the end of you.
Well, I mean, if we're on the topic of vaccination can help that too.
Exactly that.
Because you get HPV. Very much. If you get the Hep B vaccine,
as an oncologist,
you can prevent that.
As a cancer expert, it still baffles me that we can cure a very common cancer that presents very late in our population, robbing so many women and men, because they're robbing them of the mother of the child. They're robbing a daughter that could have had another 40 years on this earth. Children being raised without their mother because of this HPV that could have been prevented. Imagine if a vaccine came out, and that hopefully will happen at some point. There's a lot of research going on for prostate cancer.
Right.
Every man will be stopping work and going lining up to
get... Well, you hope so.
Well, I think...
You hope so.
I would hope so, yes.
Because...
Yes. Well, I think for breast cancer, you would have women coming in the droves, and every woman would get it.
Well, again, let's be hopeful.
Yes.
Right? But because we have the evidence now, because we have something that could prevent cervical cancer, and we don't have 100% uptake.
And
So it's choices, right?
Yes.
These are choices that don't have an immediate effect. It is discounted and it has a latent effect. You don't feel it now, but you feel it later. And so you don't make the right choice now. If it is, if it were that you would get cervical cancer now, and I can say, you take this vaccine and you can prevent it right now, then maybe people would do that. But you get it later. See, but the prevention is lifelong.
I mean, in many studies have shown that even young adult men and women up to the age of 28, there is some benefit in still getting the HPV vaccine. So it's never too late. And they look at the contrary, that the more partners you've had, the less benefit the HPV vaccine is going to have, because you've already had numerous exposures to HPV as
it's
well.
It's all about exposure,
It's all about exposure. So what you do now can affect your health 20 years from now, 40 years from now, in terms of coronary artery disease, and then we talk about coronary artery disease and the early signs of coronary artery disease, erectile dysfunction. So if you're 20 years old and you want to have your erections when you're 50, 60, 70, and 80, don't smoke, don't have red meat as a primary staple of your diet, have a normal body mass index, get exercise, and please wrap it up. You don't want to get a sexually transmitted disease.
And these are just responsible choices.
It is very responsible.
Because the choice that you make today will save your life tomorrow.
And what a lot of persons don't realize is, okay, you might have a sexually transmitted disease, and it might be a little bump in the road where you might have a foul discharge and burning when you pee. It's a lot more complex than that, because as a urologist, I'm here to say you can develop urethral strictures even
that's
months,
painful.
Years later. So you can you could have had a STI at 17.
Describe for the man what a urethral stricture is. When you say that, I cringe, because I know how painful that can possibly be.
So that basically is a formation of scar tissue within your narrow lumen urethral opening and going all the way down your shaft. And when you have an obstruction there, you need to have some surgical intervention to try to break it down. And if it recurs, you literally have to reconstruct the urethra. You need to take out that segment.
But before you reconstruct, I mean, I didn't do much urology, but you take that large dilator and you push that up there. I want every man to think about what that is.
Yeah, so we
this large metal dilator.
We will actually,
Dr. Pinto will put it there.
So it's a little bit more finesse than 20, 30
it's
years
large.
Ago. No, dilators aren't really the stay in terms of urethral strictures now. We do something called direct vision internal urethrotomy, or you call it optical urethrotomy. So under vision,
looking
on the high vat, they're asleep.
No, okay.
We use a cold knife to break down the strictures, avoiding the blood vessels.
Okay.
And in fact, one of my professors is world renowned. In fact, that he did a landmark study looking at thousands of men with urethral stricture disease, and he determined that if you need an optical urethrotomy endoscopic management more than twice, there's no point in doing it a third time. Is it going to keep happening? So two times is the maximum, and then you go into reconstruction where you'd basically remove that segment of scar tissue in your urethra.
So overall, it's just a bad disease.
Yeah. So you have to actually reconstruct your urethra using cheek cells. You scrape out the cheek cells when you're asleep. You reconstruct the urethra, and urethral strictures are actually. It's actually very well tolerated. And there's someone I actually was one of my profs as well. I'm proud that I trained with him. The number one technique in the world in terms of urethroplasty is called the Kulkarni technique. Kulkarni, I trained with him. He actually was in the Bahamas doing some difficult cases, and I don't know if you remember, but maybe 8 years ago you met him as well.
Yeah.
He's a rock star in urology. So
the bottom line is avoid these strictures.
Yes, yes. The more important thing is who gets urethral strictures. It's usually persons of a lower social economic group and the wealthiest of us, because they have this mindset that nothing can touch them.
Invincible.
They like to have reckless sex. They don't want to use a condom. And you'd be shocked, and this is cool, Connie was telling, many of his clients are the wealthiest persons on earth. They'll fly him from his clinic to this part of the world, to that part of the world. I remember one of the more well-known drug dealers in Mexico, he was flown in the private jet to go to the prison hospital to do a urethral reconstruction for this gentleman. And he says that happens all the time because that is the mindset for young men who feel there's no tomorrow, then they feel hopeless and they don't think about
choices.
Consequences.
Choices and consequences.
The richest of us men also feel like they're invincible. So the nobody's invincible. We're all human. We come into this world with nothing. We're going to leave with nothing. And disease can affect us all.
Yeah.
We look at Steve Jobs, all the money in the world. Yeah, all
Couldn't
save him from pancreatic cancer. And there are many persons who were in that position.
You know, as we talk about choices, I happen to go to church this Sunday. I don't always get to go to church because I work a lot on Sundays. But this
I will say your work is your worship, and you do a lot for society as a whole. Okay,
sure, Greg. But I just want to emphasize choices because you know, Pastor talked about Jacob and his sons, and while they were getting their inheritance, and he talked about this one called Reuben, the oldest son who was disinherited. And he was disinherited because he went with one of his father's concubines. And the scripture says he defiled the bed, right? But because of that one choice, he lost his whole inheritance, right? And so see, that one moment of pleasure that he had totally wiped out almost his generation. So just the whole idea of choices that we make, right? And how we can discount them in the moment and not recognize the consequences. And we see that all the time in our diet, our lack of activity, a lack of movement, right? Sedentary lifestyle, we call it, right?
But it goes even further than that. We talk about our society and the crime
and
violence and everything. It's just one moment of bad choices, one moment of anger, one moment almost every man in Fox Hill Prison wish they could take back.
Well, you take it back.
But they can't.
No.
That 1 minute where, and for many men, premature ejaculation afflicts 1 in 3 men. That 2 minutes, statistically speaking, of pleasure could affect your whole life, your lifespan, and cause ill health effects on a level you'd never want to experience.
Talking about unwanted pregnancies, right?
Not only that, you could be burdened with a child for 20 years and you have no ability to even support that child, much less yourself. We have a call coming in. Good evening, this urologist speaks.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Pinto and Dr. Francis.
You got his name right.
Yeah, for the first time.
I'm hoping he wouldn't let me down, and he would appear with his wife, because, you know, of course, as a pediatrician, I would like to hear what she has to say, given the fact that I have right before me a book that's called The Animal Connection, which is shows the zoonotic effects of animal products, et cetera, et cetera. And, it, you know, of course, I love how Dr. Pinto threw in the things that are induced into the cow to produce fertility and produce more yield, like the hormones and the female sex hormones and et cetera, and all these antibiotics. And one of the things this book is talking about is I had it for over 30 years, and so it speaks to, and I want you guys to confirm this with me, because it's written by Agatha Trash and her husband, I think, and it says that some cancer viruses survive pasteurization. And then when I check with Google, it says no, but it talks about the bovine, the leukemia, and all these other viruses. So, I mean, I thought the study was peer-reviewed, but this is what it's saying. This book is much older than that, but as it relates to the breast milk, the constituents. And I'm seeing there, basically, the book has before me goat, cow, and human milk, and basically the calories are the same. Goat is 165, humans is 163, cow is 160, and the fat is basically the same, with goat having 10 and cow and human having just 9, right? Which would be grams, right? And then the proteins are more with the cow and the goat milk, but then I see the human has 2.4. So it has to be a reason for that balance the way God gave it to us. So maybe that's why the children, when they're on dairy milk, they get so fat. And then I see right. The calcium here, where the cow has 288 milligrams, the goat has 315, and then the human has 88. So that's the balance. But then I see where here, iron is 0.1, goat is 0.2, and humans is 1.5. So that means it has about 15 times more than iron than the cow's milk. And then you see vitamin C has about almost 200 milligrams more than, just per cup, right, than the cow's milk. And the vitamin C is more than about 2.5 times more than what goat or cow milk produce. So then I was just trying to say that this is human milks are for human, right? Basically, but I really would like for you guys to look at this book, because it shows the zoonosis, and in the bibliography, it has a lot of information, like from warning us from decades ago about the dairy, and it talks about the xanthin oxidase, right, that is found in human, cow, and goat milk, etc. But then it speaks to how some of this is destroyed during the pasteurization or hormonization. But hormonization is just to separate, to make the fat molecules not float up to the top, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a very interesting book. And this topic is very, very complex. And so the public, just encourage mothers to breastfeed. But Dr. Pinto mentioned the passive immunity, which is great. But it actually talks about product in the cow's milk that actually promotes this arterial plaque problem that you guys are talking about. And it has a whole heap of information. I really would like for other people to just get it and share it, because But you guys could look into that as it relates to if cancer virus, because it says some cancer viruses survive pasteurization. So that's very scary, notwithstanding the other inductions that they put into the cow milk to make it more palatable to the industry. But one question for you before I leave, Dr. Francis, is that you mentioned something, you and Dr. Bindo, I don't know which one, but you talked about, let's say, native milk supply, like from like animals, like that they're supposed to be naturally in nature. Aboriginal, native tribes drink this milk, but they don't see the problems that we see with this commercialized form. That's quite interesting. I'd like for you guys to comment on that. Line up and listen.
Yeah, so it's not just in terms of dairy milk, but it's also looking at the diet as a whole. Right. We're looking at
multifactorial.
We're talking about the high level of processed foods. We're talking about the high level of protein that we ingest versus other healthier nations. And many of those healthier nations are actually third world nations. We look at the acidity of the food that we intake. There are a lot of scary things out there.
For
dairy milk, to get vitamin D in dairy milk, you have to irradiate the dairy milk. And obviously the dairy milk industry is not going to want the public to be aware of that. But the dairy milk is irradiated so that you can have vitamin D provided. So cheese, you may love cheese, but cheese does not love you back, particularly if it's derived from dairy milk. So you have to be mindful. I'll quote Dr. Walter Willett, who is the head of nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health, and he's actually the second most cited scientist in all of clinical medicine, and he has publicly called the guidelines by the USDA to drink 3 cups of milk a day utterly ridiculous. Utterly ridiculous. So we have to look at what is spearheading the information that we get. A lot of it has to do with big pharma. It has a lot to do with big industries such as dairy industry, such as the cheese industry, even a lot of studies that I say never let Google be your doctor, but you always have to look at the details of the study. Legally, they're supposed to put, are there any conflicts of interest and who actually
funded it.
So obviously, if you're going to be funded for something, you need to create a result, no matter what, that's going to support that industry making money. So we had a fascinating talk. Thank you very much for joining us. Let's have a fruitful and safe week. And thank you very much for coming, Dr. Francis. We're going to bring pediatrician extraordinaire, Dr. Maria Francis soon.
Let's see, we can work that out.
Oh, we'll work it out. All right, good night.
Good night, everybody.
All right. Yeah.